The following is a conversation between Max Kenner, founder and executive director of the Bard Prison Initiative, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
As a society, there are certain things that we think we know pretty well. One would be that with hardened and violent criminals, there really isn't much you can do but put them behind bars and keep them away from the rest of us and hope that these long jail sentences will deter others from following down the same road. But then along comes people like my next guest, who takes that thinking and absolutely turns it on its head. He is Max Kenner, the founder and executive director of a remarkable organization, the Bard Prison Initiative. He was recently named by the Chronicle of Philanthropy as one of their 40 under 40. Good evening, Max, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is the Bard Prison Initiative?
The Bard Prison Initiative is a relatively unusual institution, but what we do is really simple. And that is to say, Bard College, of course, is a private liberal arts college in the Hudson Valley.
Excellent school.
We think so. Mm-hmm. About 100 miles north of New York City. And we do lots of stuff at Bard in addition to, you know, enrolling kids on campus. We have a handful of public high schools here in New York City. And the Bard Prison Initiative is a program where we essentially run satellite campuses of Bard in prisons across New York, enrolling incarcerated women and men in college curricula that is identical in expectation, in standards, and in breadth of what we do on campus.
This is not woodworking in shop. This is not vocational training. This is something broader than that?
This is a liberal education that, again, spans the full breadth of liberal study from all of the humanities, history, sociology, anthropology, literature, but also the arts, the natural sciences, mathematics, German, Mandarin, Spanish language,
wow,
etc. The last bachelor's degree graduation we had, Cardinal Tim Dolan was mm-hmm. the commencement speaker. Fully one half of those graduates were majors in mathematics, studying and producing senior theses in math at the same level as students on campus at Bard who come from the best high schools from New York, Los Angeles, Europe, Asia, etc.
That is simply remarkable. What motivated you, Max, 15 years or so ago, to get involved with educational work in prisons? You were still a student at the time at Bard, weren't you?
I was a student at the time when the idea manifested from wherever it came from. I think, first of all, it's important to acknowledge, and this is much more widespread now, but, you know, I became aware of what we now call mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, over a period of time, really over the course of my lifetime, there was no group of public institutions that we invested in more than prisons. And all that money and all that focus that we put into criminal punishment and the institutions, extremely expensive institutions at the center of that system, came from somewhere. And it came from the educational system.
Oh, that's great.
So,
unbelievable.
You know, as a young person, and you know, I was an undergraduate at Bard, and it was the first time I really worked hard as a student, tried as a student, first time I was really happy as a person. So it was, for me, liberal education was something liberating unto itself in my personal experience. And I thought, A, the world should have more of this. But I also thought at the center of our criminal justice policy lay a certain cynicism and fear mm-hmm. about young people. And if we could approach those people who are investing all this money in putting away, if we could approach them with a sense of optimism, maybe results would be different.
Yeah. Give our listeners a little bit of context about this mass incarceration experiment. How big has this prison industrial complex become?
Sure. So in the United States today, we have the largest prison system, not only in the world, but in the history of the world.
Wow.
Roughly 2.5 million people behind bars any given day. Again, it has been the largest growth sector within government, within the public sector over the last 30 or 40 years. And what's most tragic about it, and I think all Americans intuit this, they know it whether they say it or not, is that who goes to prison mm-hmm. is not unpredictable. That is to say, the vast majority of people in jail and in prison across the United States are young men of color who come from highly concentrated geographical regions. Mm-hmm. That is to say, so for example, in New York City, right, the overwhelming majority of people in prison come from certain sections of the Bronx, certain sections of Brooklyn, et cetera, right? And that's true across the United States. And so when you look at those neighborhoods by themselves, right, there are blocks in Brooklyn where we spend $1 million a year incarcerating people from that block. Hmm. You imagine, think of it that way, you know, there's different ways we might spend that money. And you look at the neighborhood that way and you think, well, the net is cast so wide, there must be people of real talent and ambition who are capable of things that are very different than what we as a society expect of them.
How do you find this real talent and ambition inside the walls of a prison? And by that I mean, what is the application process? How do you select those students that will get to go to Bard inside a prison?
Sure. So every summer, and there's some variations here, but more, if I were to generalize, more or less every summer we do admission at each prison where we're...
Six, right?
That's right. We're in six prisons in New York State. And so in the summertime, we announce that we'll be doing admission. People, women or men, depending on the institution, have the opportunity to put themselves forward. And then we sit everybody down in a cafeteria, or gymnasium, or a series of classrooms, and provide a couple prompts and solicit a piece of writing. People have a couple hours to work on. We take those pieces of writing back to campus, you know, and if Max writes something which is perfect English, understands what a paragraph is, a sentence, a clause of a sentence, perfect grammar, but writes the most boring thing anyone has ever read, you know, Max will move on to the next stage and get an interview.
Mm-hmm.
But if Denver, you know, writes something that's borderline illiterate, broken English, real trouble with language, but clearly gleans something from the reading and is clearly thinking, and maybe, you know, just doesn't have the raw tools, he'll also get an interview.
Yeah.
And maybe be a better student, you know, than Max seems to be. So then we do interviews. They're highly personal. They're highly subjective. We're not looking for any one thing. There are no bubble tests. There are no number two pencils. It's high stakes, but it's not high stakes testing in the conventional sense. And we look for people who really want to do it. And, you know, throughout American history, there have been groups of people who've accomplished more in education, who have taken better advantage of educational opportunity than others. We think of immigrants throughout American history.
Sure.
80 years ago, the best colleges in the United States were community colleges here in New York, in Brooklyn and Queens,
CCNY.
Filled with people who were not allowed to go to the fancier, more famous places, right? Over the course of the 20th century, GIs, people returning home from foreign wars, transformed the landscape of American higher education. And we never, ever talk about it, but there was no group of people who accomplished more in education, took more risk, and made more progress through education than the generation or two of Americans who were emancipated from slavery.
Yeah.
And so what I would argue is that incarcerated Americans today in our America are analogous to those other groups. People who are just desperate for an opportunity to prove to themselves and their families and their communities that they're going to make something really substantial with their lives.
Yeah, and you talk about families. I was really impressed by the number of guys who wanted to be a role model for their children, who desperately wanted their kids to be proud. And that was an incredibly motivating factor, wasn't it?
I think that's true. And I think, you know, there's incredible hardship for people in prison, long-term prison, who want to be parents and have children. The vast majority of people in prison do have children. So how do you facilitate that kind of relationship? How do you permit a person who wants nothing more than to support their children to do that? And then when they're released, be a parent in a way which hands down a legacy to that child of something other than failure and humiliation and stigma.
Yeah.
And nothing does that more than education, and particular college education.
Absolutely. Now, this is the same faculty, Max, that teaches the courses at the main campus in Bard. What has their experience been? How have they responded to teaching prison inmates?
Well, I would say, first of all, it's the same faculty, but it's also the same curriculum.
Right.
And it's the same standards.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's just worth emphasizing because, you know, the vast majority of our students have failed in conventional schooling. You might say the school's failed them.
whatever.
I'm agnostic, whatever, precisely. Our students, what's most extraordinary and in some ways the cause for the most optimism and in other ways the cause for the most despair is that very often our students who prove the most intellectually ambitious and curious, the kinds of people who go from algebraic illiteracy to being majors in math, the people who are inspired by continental literature or philosophy and decide they have to learn German so they can read Hegel in the original, people who do this kind of stuff as adults very often are the same people who dropped out of conventional school the youngest, right? So they're really defying expectations. They're doing that because they get the feeling, they have the sense that something truly extraordinary is at stake in the classroom. So the faculty from Bard, to answer your question, when they arrive in these classrooms, right, there is an energy and enthusiasm and passion which reminds the faculty of why they got into this line of work to begin with.
Yeah, I sometimes think they have to get a completely different demographic charge. They're getting so many kids, I would imagine, at Bard who come from similar backgrounds. And they're purists at heart when it comes to teaching. And to be able to extend it to a completely different population has really just got to be uplifting and very motivating.
You know, I think we're going through a period of American history where there is a true crisis of confidence in the academy.
Mm-hmm.
People say the things that we care about, ideas, science, the arts, are irrelevant in the 20th century. That is a fashionable position. You hear it from people on the left, you hear it from people on the right, at the local level, at the presidential level. And it's wrong. And what is so, you know, yes, it's a different demographic than the students on campus in a lot of different ways, but I fear that not only college faculty, but university presidents, university trustees have bought into the idea, even if they deny it, that the stuff we do and the stuff that has happened in Western civilization, the academy, for many hundreds of years is somehow not current.
Mm.
And that couldn't be more wrong. There's no kind of education that can train a workforce and be fulfilling for a person in the 21st century than a liberal education.
I don't think there's any question about that. And if you begin to see that so many of these jobs are being outsourced to artificial intelligence and robotics and the kind, it's going to be a liberal arts education which is going to allow that distinctive population to be able to connect the dots. And they are going to be in a very, very good place at that time. What's the impact of this program, not just on the students, but on the entire prison environment, the institution at large?
I think the most important thing we do is not exclusively the impact we have on the students themselves.
You have, what, about 350 right now?
We have over 300 students right now.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as you alluded to, there's the impact on the families and the communities and the children in particular. But when we have a substantial part of a prison enrolled in something like a college, so for example, at Eastern Correctional Facility in the Catskills, you know, on any given day, between 10 and 15% of that institution is enrolled with Bard. Now, that's a real number. And it's transformative as an opportunity to the men enrolled, but it says to the whole population that this is a good faith effort.
Mm-hmm.
And as challenging and as difficult as long-term incarceration is, each individual in that institution, if they try and if they make an effort and they put their best foot forward, there's a path for them for something completely different.
Yep. You know, a complaint that I'm sure you've heard is going to be this, and that is a middle-class couple working really hard, has a daughter. They can't afford to send her to college, and certainly not a college as good and expensive as Bard. Yet on the other hand, you have these individuals inside a prison who have committed these crimes against society, and they're getting a free education while they can't send their daughter to college. How do you respond to that charge?
Well, I don't think it's a charge.
Mm-hmm.
There is a genuine crisis in the United States today of college access and opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
What's frustrating about that to us is that it strikes us as an institution as the wrong question,
mm-hmm.
which is to say, we're in the business of education, right? We're in the business of providing this kind of opportunity to students that are curious and ambitious wherever we can find them. And the leaders in higher education and the presidents of universities have failed to be imaginative in bringing these to different pockets of the United States outside of, you know, anything but the most conventional, normal kind of college admission-y kind of thing, which is failing us okay? So to us, it's precisely the wrong question. When we look at the crisis of college access in the United States, we look at this and say, this works.
Yep.
This is engaging people at extremely low cost in a transformative education, and we should look at this way of doing business and replicate and multiply it, not say just because one group doesn't have something, we should take it from everyone. Quite the contrary, because this works and because this is such cause for optimism and leads to such results that all the experts would say are impossibly good, we shut it down? That makes no sense.
Makes no sense. Unfortunately, society very often responds in that way, and it never has and it never will make any sense. Let's talk about incarceration rates for those who've been through the program. I know that this is sentence blind, so sometimes these prisoners don't get a chance to graduate because they get out too soon. But I think if we look at incarceration rates, we tend to look at that three-year time frame.
That's right.
How have those who have either graduated or attended Bard College in prison done compared to the population in general?
Well, you know, if you look at our work and the success of our students from the perspective of a social scientist, mm-hmm. again, the results are impossibly good. So this growth of the prison system in the United States has been built on this thing that we now refer to as recidivism, which is, say, people go to prison for relatively small infractions of the law, become unemployable, are returned to society, commit a more serious crime, and are incarcerated for a long time. So national recidivism rates in the United States range between 40 and 60%.
Right.
Advocates in criminal justice like to say if this was a business and you had 40 to 60% rates of failure,
yeah.
the leadership would be disposed of, right?
You wouldn't return that many products. You know, you'll be out of business if you did that.
Exactly right. So for our students, for any student who's been enrolled and spent any significant amount of time with us, those rates are not 40 or 60%,
mm-hmm.
but roughly 4%.
Wow.
And for women or men who've completed a degree with us, it's between 2 and 3%.
Yeah, and a lot of them get jobs when they reenter society as well.
Students are in reentry as they return to New York City, are absolutely thriving. They're working in business. They're working in management of major businesses. They are in graduate school, places like Columbia,
mm-hmm.
NYU, Yale, all across the CUNY system, which is such a magnificent resource. But most of all, and this is really important and really touching, most of all, our students who've gone to prison for serious amounts of time, mostly for very serious convictions, have returned to the neighborhoods from which they've come, the most isolated, the most poor, the most needy communities we have, to serve the interests of those neighborhoods, and in particular to serve youth who are considered to be at risk, who have failed or been failed by the school system, and working with young people, working with the homeless, working with people with HIV and AIDS,
yeah.
and being exactly the kind of citizen you would hope for of anyone, not just someone returning home from prison.
No question about it. I mean, that's a wonderful moral compass that they are so motivated to give back. Let me ask you this. What does this teach you, teach us, about some of these intractable social problems and what we think we know about them? I mean, this can't be the only thing that we are completely wrong about. What other things do you think we're completely wrong about, or what kind of thinking does it lead to on your part?
I'd respond to that question in two or three ways. The first is, I think we're successful, as we are with our students, because we work at a human scale. The relationship we have with those students is intimate and it's real, and they know we have their best aspirations and ambitions in mind when we build it.
They know you care.
In philanthropy, all, you know, you bring all these people into the studio to talk about, you know, what we do in philanthropy. All the fashion says that you should do scale and you should measure people's success
mm-hmm.
in the most inhumane, remote, scientific kind of way, which I don't know, you know, I would never respond to as a student, and I can't imagine why anyone would, right? So there is a sense of optimism and concern and love at the center of what we do as an institution, number one. Number two, we, and this gets to the crux of your question, you know, we always talk about working to make things better rather than less bad.
Mm-hmm.
And when people approach institutions like prisons and the people within them, they think if you just reduce recidivism, if you just produce a person who comes back to New York City, has a minimum wage job, that's a great success. And that doesn't inspire people.
Mm.
So if you approach people with, again, a sense of optimism and concern, you can get results that all the social scientists will tell you are impossible. They're impossible from the criminal justice perspective, in that recidivism is so low, etc., and they're impossible from the educational perspective. No one thinks that these kinds of people, quote unquote, who dropped out of school so young and have failed in so many institutions can succeed at this level academically, but they do, and they do it at scale.
They certainly do. Tell us why this issue has garnered so much attention of late, and what is it about it that one of the few things, maybe the only thing, that has really brought the left and the right together in a constructive way?
Look, there's no question, there's no issue in the American landscape which has proven immune to some of the worst excesses of our sense of partisanship and rancor in the American political landscape as criminal justice. You know, you can't claim to be a small government conservative and believe, or a member of the Freedom Caucus, etc., and be an advocate of the largest state prison system in the history of the world. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And liberals, you know, not always good, not always perfect on this issue by any stretch, represent communities that are absolutely ravaged by both crime and punishment. And when we think of our society at large, right, and we live in a supposedly, you know, Christian society, right, there is no way we can have the central institutions in our public life be ones of purely punishment and cynicism.
How is all this financed? Is it by taxpayers? Is it through BARD? Or do you go around knocking on doors, raising private funds?
Sure. Well, just a little bit of history. So for a generation, there was college opportunity in every prison in the United States, state and federal. And the reason that was because the work is so embarrassingly, if you're me and you're in the business of fundraising, embarrassingly inexpensive. And as a sort of really vitriolic moment, the peak of the tough on crime frenzy of the 1990s, people in prison were made explicitly ineligible for federal Pell Grants, despite a huge body of evidence which showed that programs like these did more to reduce recidivism, reduce violence, create relationships with a person in prison, their family, etc. All the things we hope a prison would do, eliminated overnight.
Right. And they were only about 1/10 of 1% of all the Pell Grants.
That's exactly
I think you
right.
had about, what, 350 programs at the time, and now we're down to 8.
Whatever the number is, no one knows exactly. But in terms of how we pay for this program, you know, it's very unusual. You know, very few not-for-profits have no stream of regular revenue. And we're a tiny little college, not BARD, but BPI.
Yeah.
No students can pay tuition.
Yep.
Our students make, you know, between 15 and 30 cents an hour. No students pay tuition. There's no endowment. And there's no government money. So, you
good
know,
luck.
Well, we're still here 15 years later.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality that at some point we'll fail is liberating to us. We only exist because of the generosity and magnanimousness of people who very often have no direct relationship with our students, but are moved by the purity and unusualness of our mission.
One thing that really blew me away is what the president of BARD, Leon Botstein, said. And it was this: the best students we have are the undergraduate students we have in prison. They are the most curious, the most disciplined, the most original, the most hardworking. That's truly an incredible statement.
It is an incredible statement. I don't think it's inaccurate. And that's not to say anything at the expense of any other undergraduates. But as we talked about before, these are students for whom something unusual and extraordinary is at stake. And it's our position that colleges like BARD, that the best universities across the United States should be in the market for these kinds of students, not just in prison, but students who will make the most of the opportunity, who are not going to college because it's something equivalent to a social club or something their parents did, but because there's something truly meaningful at stake for them.
Well, they certainly made the most of the opportunity when they took on the Harvard debate team. Tell us about that.
Sure. So, you know, again, we try to replicate college learning as broadly and authentically as possible in the work we do in the prisons. So that is reflected in the curriculum, which we've talked about. It's reflected in the extraordinary faculty we have. But there are also some extracurricular things which goes on, one of which is we have at Eastern Correctional Facility in particular, a debate club, a debate team. West Point the debate team from West Point comes in every spring. They'll be coming in a few weeks. That's a big event, and we did that for a few years and then started doing competitions in the fall. Harvard came. There was a debate. It was a split decision, but the incarcerated Bard students representing BPI defeated Harvard.
You got the W.
And that became a media sensation we naively did not anticipate. But I just want to say just two things about that, which really were really moving.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the kids from Harvard were fantastic and wonderful and very gracious, and that needs to be said. But in addition to that, right, you've alluded to how polarizing in the past the politics around this work could be. And ironically, the event with Harvard sort of changed that and helped it evolve. And the reason that I think that's true is because so often in American life, in American politics, when we talk about being inclusive in education, people implicitly believe, they react emotionally as if what we're really saying is let's lower standards for someone else. And when you hear about these guys in prison defeating an institution with a richness of brand and history like Harvard, you know immediately no one's lowering any standards, right? And it's the same when it comes to cost, right? When people talk about something being free, they assume it's some kind of handout. And just that event proved to the world, I think, that our students are working extraordinarily hard, accomplishing extraordinary things, and doing all the things anyone would hope people in prison might be doing.
Let me get you out on this. What you have done for these men and women is quite remarkable and amazing. But as always the case in situations like this, Bard often gets back even more. How would you express that?
There are ways that I think the faculty are rejuvenated and participating in this kind of work that's wonderful. But I think what's of most value to an institution like Bard in doing this work is that we spend our lives as faculty and administrators advocating for a set of values, which again is out of fashion. And the work that we do in the prison proves to the undergraduates on campus that we really believe this stuff,
number one.
And the success and the passion of the students prove that the things and the ideals and the values to which we have dedicated our lives are as meaningful as we might have ever hoped.
Well said. If people want to get more information about the Bard Prison Initiative or maybe even financially support this extraordinary program, where can they go to do that?
Our website is bpi.bard.edu, and we always have our hat out and appreciate the opportunity to make that ask. Thank you very much.
Max Kenner, founder and executive director of the Bard Prison Initiative, thank you for being here for a really fascinating conversation. It was great having you on the program.
This was lots of fun.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.